Hi from Seattle, Washington. Actually, Issaquah, Washington. This is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jara.
And you're listening to Coast.
To Coast.
Bio. It's our new podcast. We have no idea what it's going to be about as we go along, but for the first episode, what we're going to do is try and figure out and let you know what our goals are, what why we started, and so on and so forth. So, hi, Hari. It's late for you.
Yeah, it's almost 11 o'clock on a Saturday, though. So I'm normally out, like, clubbing and stuff. But, you know, today is podcast time. I'm kidding, of course.
Yeah, but no, actually, we were supposed to record this on Sunday night, and then I suddenly realized that I actually had to catch a plane to Los Angeles. So that's going to be still our regular time. Anyway, yeah, so why did we start this podcast? Why don't you give everyone your thoughts behind what led to starting Coast to Coast Bio?
Okay, well, I guess I'll start with an admission. I am kind of a podcast junkie. Quite a few of the podcasts I started listening to thanks to Adam and a friend of mine. And let's say, listening to these podcasts, I kind of figured that I wanted to talk back as an add to the conversation that's out there. And while we're at it, I might as well tell you what I do. I'm mostly a biochemist and protein crystallographer, pretty much wedded to the bench. I use the pipette. I don't know if Adam knows what a pipette is.
Yeah, but just for the record, Adam is me.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
In case.
So, yeah, it is pretty much a desire to add to the conversation that's out there. And so that's at least my motivation. How about yours, Adam?
Yeah, so obviously I've dabbled with podcasts and video before. And one of the things that frustrated me at the time, and one reason I haven't done it much of late, other than the fact that I haven't had the time, is that it's very difficult to do it by yourself. It's almost a monologue all the time. And you want things to be a little more of a conversation, as you alluded to.
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, and some time ago, I heard this podcast called Stack Overflow by Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood. And Joel and Jeff are a bunch of programmers. They actually have a website now called Stack Overflow for programming knowledge and so on and so forth. But way before the site went live, they basically talked every Sunday. Joel is on the East Coast. Jeff's on the West Coast, just like us. And they talk about programming. They talk about things of importance to them. And, you know, that sort of got me thinking, and we've talked about the idea on and off over time, and I figured it was a great it would be a good thing to just talk, because I think you have some interests in the life sciences and programming and technology, and I have some interests, and we don't always agree with each other, which is always good.
Yeah, so you might find us arguing incessantly, and if you do, just drop us a line. But
I don't even know if you have an email address. If you have one, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I guess. Well, we'll figure that out.
So I mean, the format that we'll follow, I mean, I think it's going to be a cross between Stack Overflow, Net at Night, GDGT, and as we go along, it'll evolve into the Hari and Deepak format.
Yeah, there you go. And I'll add my influence as well. I really like the Java Posse podcast. It's I've been listening to it for a while. It's funnily enough, I don't yet code in Java, but I just love listening to, you know, the treatment of the subject. I mean, I've learned Java back in the day, but yeah. So let's say that our format will be a mishmash of our influences, and of course, colored to a significant extent by what we do.
Yeah, and just. So there's for the one person who listened to this podcast who doesn't know who I am. I'm a blogging junkie. I've been blogging at mndoci.com.
Oh my God, we're both junkies. Yeah. You know that now.
Yeah. And obviously, I left the sciences a while ago, at least doing science, but I worked in the life science industry in the software informatics world for a while. But now I work in the world of cloud computing with Amazon. So I'll bring that side of the world and hopefully and represent that here as well. So let's get this ball rolling on this. And what did you want to talk about today?
Well, I noticed that you'd bookmarked a really cool article about, what was it, bringing relational databases and wikis together. And I thought I'll start off the discussion with, There's been so many wikis that have kind of cropped up there. I mean, some of them are old, but it just seems like just about everybody who's, having a collaborative group of biologists or whatever out there has a wiki, and these wikis are getting really, really content rich.
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects to it, with wikis, and it's a conversation I've had with lots of people over time. I mean, a wiki is, in the end, is a content management system. It's a type of content management system. It has some features in terms of collaboration and the ability to track changes and the ability to essentially have a sandbox where different people can contribute at roughly the same level of permission or some control. And I think it lends itself very well to a number of cases. Take, for example, TopSan, which is something that Burnham has come up with, and it's a structural biology wiki.
Oh, yeah? I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, actually, so they're part of the whole PSI, and they're one of the PSI centers, and what they're doing is they're putting the structures that they're putting up there. Not all of them have functional information. Not all of them have additional information, right? So it's topsan.org. It's also written on, it's by the way, developed on MindTouch. On Deki.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an example of the kind of wiki that makes sense to me because it's information that people like you who might have expertise in a particular area on a particular protein or somebody who's done some work, functional work on, on sort of homology modeling or in the lab can add and annotate. And I think that's the value that a wiki brings, especially because at the back end, you are capturing it in a database, which you can, in theory, query out even without the wiki format, if you ever wanted to go in that direction. E. coli Hub, for example, one of their goals is to make their wiki. The wiki is essentially the front end to entering the information, but they plan to make it programmatically available to other right. people through APIs. And I think that's where the real power comes in. The wiki is how you get stuff in. It's not how you get stuff out necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's been, I myself find that I've pretty much transitioned to putting every solution I find, like, you know, if I'm working on a particular, say, compiling a particular program for crystallography, once I figure out how to do it, I have my own personal wiki. Well, it's only personal because I'm the only one who right now contributes to it, but I pretty much write into it right away. And it's funny because I've been doing this for around 6 months now. And every once in a while, I'll Google for a particular solution, and it's very heartening to see the solution right on my wiki. So yeah, as you said, it's very useful to add content, and the platform I really have started using a lot is the Deki Wiki. I really like the WYSIWYG-ness of it. I mean, I used to use MediaWiki. I mean, as you know, we used to use MediaWiki a while back. But I found that after some time, you know, the barrier to learning the markup was enough that when I wanted to quickly write down something, I didn't feel like, you know, adding the double equal twos and so on. And yeah, I really like Deki Wiki. And the crystallography space has had this explosion of wikis in the last year. And a lot of them are closed, but they are contributed to by the program authors themselves, who put in, you know, their versions of how the program should be run. And that's such a useful resource that I pretty much, you know, I first check the wiki and then go back to the paper where they describe the method. And it's really changing the way I use the web. I mean, I pretty much live on a bunch of the wikis which correspond to the programs that I use for a lot of the crystallographic analysis.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't really have a problem with people having closed wikis in terms of who can contribute to it. There is the openness. You know, in some cases, having open wikis helps a lot. In other cases, you're closing it and controlling who can contribute. The best part is making it available to other people as a knowledge base. And I think that's the power of, even Wikipedia for that matter. And I'm still conflicted about people using Wikipedia as a scientific resource. I know Andrew Su is whom I met and talked with quite a bit on this, has the Genes Wiki running on Wikipedia. Uh-huh. I've always felt that Wikipedia is a great general resource.
Yeah.
And that as an expert resource, it fails because it's difficult for people. It's not designed, it's meant to be a general resource. It's not designed, optimized for certain things. Now, with MediaWiki or with Deki or with anything else using extensions and so on, if you're doing it for your particular use case, you can customize it. and optimize it for that use case. And I think to me, that works better than a generalized system, which Wikipedia is. Wikipedia has been designed to do lots of things decently, not do a few things really well. So Rod Page, for example, started building MediaWiki extensions for some of his phylogenetic stuff, which are pretty cool as well. So I like what people are doing. Yeah.
Yeah, I should check that out. And even there's the what was it, the Wiki Proteins thing. I don't think that really took off, did it? The one from
I don't know. I mean, I haven't really seen it take off at all, actually.
Actually, and speaking of this, did you see that article in Nature about, or it was somewhere out there about a refutal from Encyclopedia Britannica about the original article, which Nature did, supposedly, which said that, you know, what, more articles on Encyclopedia Britannica have errors in them than Wikipedia? So the Encyclopedia Britannica came back with its refutal, saying the original research wasn't as accurate, and that you know, that Nature conveniently disregarded certain facts, and by and large, Encyclopedia Britannica is more accurate. But I mean, anyway, yeah, the fact of the matter is,
and the fact remains is that I use Wikipedia a lot. I mean, I'm not crazy. I won't take everything they say at face value over there.
Right.
But you and I and anybody else are going to do a good job of making sure that we have our facts straight, that we check multiple resources. And you can usually tell when an article is very biased. And I think we are smart enough to tell. But in general, I actually think in schools, people, instead of saying, go check Wikipedia, should be using Wikipedia as a model to teach kids how to use references, how to reference information.
Right.
How to identify. And to some extent, the Wikipedia guidelines are a great way of teaching kids how to do that, because if you look at how you're supposed to write a Wikipedia article with the references and the style, it tries to make sure that people are basing it on reference information rather than just personal opinion.
In fact, even the article you'd bookmarked, what is amazing that, you know, you have these three or four different schemes to kind of categorize and index your article when you're writing it, that it kind of forces you to think how you're going to organize the information. I mean, granted, no article is written by only one or two people on Wikipedia, but say on a limited wiki, it's there's so much interlinking that goes on that, it's authoring a wiki page is a great exercise in just organizing information, albeit at a very, very, you know, what do you call it, microscopic level.
That's definitely true. And actually, sort of moving on to our next topic, but sticking to the databases idea, it's something I saved to the Delicious page that we created. And just those who don't use Delicious too much, Delicious is actually a great resource when you're doing something like this podcast, because you can put up stories that you want to cover, and you might want to let the other person know, or just for your own reference. You can put them up on Delicious, because with a Firefox bookmarklet, especially Firefox extension, it makes it very easy to do so. So Hari and I have been putting our bookmarks onto delicious.com/c2cbio with a letter 2 for the two part of it. Anyway, one of the things that I put up there was this: when is a database not a database? And the reason I put it up there was, this is something that I've been talking to a lot of people about lately. Duncan Hull, I think, had put something similar up on FriendFeed. Maybe that's how
Duncan Hull, the Taverna person? Or?
Yeah, he's working on something else these days, not on Taverna.
I see.
So basically, I think biologists, life scientists, don't quite appreciate a database. Very often, they'll just put everything in flat files and call it a database. one of the challenges that I think, especially as our data sets get more and more complicated and larger, that I think the field life science needs to realize is what the importance of data is. Just about half an hour, 1 hour ago on Hacker News, I was reading an article by somebody where they were essentially talking about getting your data model and data structures right first. Once you do that, the code and algorithms actually become a lot more logical and easy.
Right.
So if you know what your data looks like and how your data is structured, and you think, put a lot of thought into your data side, it definitely helps your coding. Now, it's not always possible, but there was a slide I used to put up when I was at Rosetta, which basically said, data management is not data storage, which is sort of the similar philosophy. It's not just about putting your data somewhere. It's how can you be smart about it? How can you make sure that it's optimal to query out? How can you make sure that you get it in a way that makes it, you know, easy to get back out? Things like that. And I think we should, I mean, you are in the trenches, so, but even based on my past experiences, I don't think people give that enough thought. And while in many cases, it doesn't matter, in a lot of cases, it is going to matter, and it's going to come and bite you on the backside. So that's something I'm, you know, it's almost like this thing I want to beat into everybody's head to start thinking about what you do with your data, how you manage it, and not just treat it as, oh, we can put it up in a flat file system and everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, and do you find that, I mean, in a way that the people who are creating the data are in some ways better equipped to create those models, or do you think that's a job better left to the bioinformaticians and so on? I mean, personally, I don't know. I feel that of course, data has different value to different people, but as I'm doing an experiment, I feel like, you know, okay, these are the 10 attributes of the experiment that I think are really important. And so if I was to come up with a model, I would right away put, you know, like just thinking in terms of database, put those 10 attributes in right away into like a column or something. And as long as that's there, you know, I'm happy. But yeah, just wondering whether you think who's the best person.
I actually think it's a collaboration. So I'll take you back to what we did at Geneformatics. So we used to pull in data from all places, you know, from multiple sources. We used to generate our own data libraries and resources and capture all the metadata. And we had two database people. One was a database admin, I mean, a hardcore database person, no biology. The other person was a database architect, but with a life science background. And the two of them used to, essentially design our database and how to optimize it and everything. But everything was done in collaboration with the scientists who were going to query the data out.
I see.
And what they were going to be interested in. And I think in every case, it has to be done like that. You are more savvy than most people. I think most people don't think about it like you anyway. Plus, I think those 10 things that you are pulling out, somebody else might find 5 other things of interest.
Right.
Which you might not care about. So you have to think about it in that respect and make that possible as well. And for that, I think you need somebody in the middle who understands data modeling and so on. But yeah, you just throw the data at somebody and say, oh, figure out how to handle it. That's not going to work either. It has to be, you have to have purpose behind what you're trying to do.
And so, you've been tracking a lot of the kind of public data availability platforms out there, right? Like things like Dabble, DB, and so on. So what's your general take? I mean, they've been around for probably like a year now. Has there been a lot of adoption of people putting, you know, data on, say, like things like Dabble? I mean, that's the only one that comes to my mind. But what else?
Yeah, no, I haven't. I mean, I would say that the trend definitely that I am seeing, and, you know, I had a chance to meet Matt Wood this week, and he could speak to it even better than I can. But the trend that I have been seeing is...
Who's Matt Wood?
He has a blog called Green is Good.
I see.
Uh-huh. He's also the guy who's gave the RailsConf talk called Genome on Rails. He heads the production software group at the Sanger Institute in the UK.
Oh, wow. Okay, I see.
Yeah. So they have their whole high-throughput genomics
next-gen sequencing platform. Hey, is that
EMSA? Yeah, that's MZA on Twitter. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
This is what life's coming to now. You know, is he EMSA? Yeah, he is.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. Same person. So the trend that I've seen, in the past, we used to put everything in flat files. Then everybody started putting everything in big Oracle databases or something like that, or MySQL databases. And now people are actually thinking about it and trying to figure, as data sets get bigger and you can't just dump everything into a database, what's the best way to handle this data? So for example, at Rosetta for our genotyping data, we were using HDF5 as our file system. It's a file system designed for large-scale numerical data sets developed by NCSA.
I see.
Other people, I think, looking at things like Bigtable or CouchDB. I actually spoke to somebody, had an email exchange with somebody who's thinking about using CouchDB for something. Mm-hmm. People are looking at other kinds of, you know, non-relational systems. But normally in collaboration with, normally in conjunction with a relational system, where some data is good to put in a relational database, but other, especially when you want to access it very quickly, when you want to, but not all the time. You might want it in this distributed data set, you know, HDFS or HBase or one of these file systems that are, I think, going to be the, over the next few years, that's going to be the big trend. People using CouchDB, SimpleDB, HBase to store their data sets.
I see. Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, I think every database is a relation database. I mean, I don't even know of the other, you know, I think flat file and I think relation database. To me, there's nothing else out there. So I guess, we should probably explore these spaces as the episodes go by.
Yeah, I mean, actually, absolutely. So I mean, example of a tuple store that's doing publicly, at least you'll see, I mean, other than Google maybe, is Freebase. They have a big tuple store at the back. They don't use the relational set. They don't use, they don't even use RDF tuples. They actually have this n-tuple kind of store at the back, which allows querying along their sort of MQL, works very well in that kind of graph. Because most of these databases store their data as some kind of graph, right? So that's the idea. So yeah, so that was sort of the thing I wanted to bring up, and was a great segue from what you talked about. So.
Yeah, I mean, reading that article that you did, the databases aren't really databases. I had no idea the wealth of extensions for MediaWiki that are out there. It's just incredible. I mean, you know, you can do just about everything you want to with the MediaWiki extension. And I spent like a couple of days last week actually writing an extension for DeckiWiki, and It was something like 15 lines of code, and it was so powerful to be able to then. So this is basically an extension that I wrote for the BioScreencast wiki, whereby you can just kind of type a few, you know, lines and embed a video right away. So say you have a tutorial screencast, and you can just about say BioScreencast.embed and give the screencast ID, and you know, just embed the wiki, the screencast right away. That was just, it took me like 20 lines to write this extension up. And it was so useful then, because then I could write documentation and just not worry about, you know, moving screen, you know, editing HTML or something. Just, I'm just freeform typing, and the extension took care of everything. And I guess you were saying, right, there's so many extensions out there, right, that do like chemical structures inside of inline of databases and query.
What's the guy who does who's the Ubuntu guy? Mark Shuttleworth. He said that at OSCON, right? Build platforms that allow other people to do cool stuff on top of it.
Right.
And he gave used Firefox as his best example, because I mean, the reason Firefox is so popular is the plugins. We are also tied to our plugins. I mean, I'm locked in. I can't leave, because there's a bunch of plugins I can't live without. So you know, definitely, I think I would really like people to start doing that more and more. I think Taverna is an example of a workflow system, which is essentially plugin-based, or Cytoscape or something like that. I don't think they're designed that well. I think they're too heavy. I think they're too heavy, but I have a feeling we'll start seeing a lot more of that. But I noticed in your list you had put on something on BioCarta, and since we're on wikis and databases, maybe... What made you bookmark BioCarta for this podcast?
So BioCarta seemed pretty. It was a very simple idea of people creating pathways, and in fact, their tagline is BioCarta charting pathways of life. And I was just thinking of what I mean. There's so many pathway databases out there. And it seems like what BioCarta basically allows, at least the part of BioCarta that I investigated, what it allows you to do is custom kind of draw in a pathway into their system. And, immediately I imagined some fancy Flex application where you can draw, you know, drag and drop stuff in. But actually it was, in a way, easier than that. They have all these extensive templates, so you can download like a, you know, Adobe Illustrator or Microsoft Word template, and pretty much offline, say you're an authority on a particular pathway, you can draw in the pathway, and I'm imagining send it to them, and then they and they link these graphic pathways into proteins and so on in their pathway databases. So it kind of gives you a snapshot graphical illustration of a pathway. And they have very cool widgets, like, you know, default things for like receptors and a cell. And you draw these things in and send it back to them and link it up to the back-end proteins. So it's kind of like, it seemed like a front end to map a lot of protein data with the front end of a graphical pathway database. And
yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, it seemed pretty cool, actually. And it was a wiki as well, but in a way it was like a graphical wiki where people are contributing, user-contributed, you know, flowcharts of interactions and so on.
Yeah, it'll be very neat if you can plug that into Cytoscape, actually, and have actually Cytoscape write out something, do something like that. I actually can't get into Biocarta. It tells me that there's some malicious thing going on, so you'll have to look into that.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah. My Firefox identifies it as an attack site.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Which is probably not the case.
So
if this podcast
crashes, we know why.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we wanted to... How long have you been going at the podcast? About 30 minutes or something like that?
Yeah. Actually, my counter says 25. But, yeah.
Okay. We talked randomly for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So actually, you know, sort of taking a segue out of talking serious stuff, when we were talking about it, we wanted to keep this at 35 minutes, and I think Hari has a good story for why.
It comes from unofficial statistics that I've compiled in my head, and that is a theme that you'll notice here, that when we don't have hard facts, we compile them in our head. But anyway, no, my average commute is around 30 to 35 minutes. And to me, an ideal podcast is one that I can start listening to when I get into the car, and pretty much it ends as soon as I arrive at the parking lot. And we compared notes, and I think Atom's commute is about the same as mine. So we figured we'd try and keep our episodes at 35 minutes, at least for the initial parts.
Yeah, plus I think anything over 35 and you start losing your audience. You know, there's some podcasts that go on and on and on, and they aren't that interesting.
But I don't know. Nowadays, I like listening to Floss Weekly a lot. For everybody out there who is in any way connected with open source software, this is a great podcast. And it comes from the Twits table, and it's done by Leo Laporte and Randall Schwartz, the person who wrote a lot of Perl books and so on. And this, I mean, I think the episodes for this one run around 1 hour, right? You would say? Or?
Yeah. Most of the Twit family stuff is between 45 minutes.
Yeah. And this podcast, I mean, there are some people who are on there. Like, there was this one episode that, Atom, I know you also liked a lot, the one by Dan Ingles, where he was talking about
single best podcast I've ever heard, I think.
That was an incredible. I've probably, you know, to convince you of my junkiness, I've heard that episode like 3 times over. There's just everything he says.
I heard it twice.
Yeah, makes you want to be like that. And that's a podcast that, you know, if it goes on longer than 1 hour, you're like, okay, it's all good. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think apart from the fact that it was a really good podcast and the fact that you have people like Randall doing it, Dan Ingles came across as one of the smartest.
Oops.
Oh, gosh. We lost our connection, so let's pause here. Let's keep recording and pause. Back.
Comcasted? Is that the term? I don't know. I just suddenly lost connection.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it suddenly went boom. It was from your side, I think.
Right? Yeah, you never know. Actually, I got this really strange email. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. It said that somebody's trying to break into my account, and when I looked at who it was... a network monitoring service from Comcast. I have no idea. I don't steal music. I don't do anything, you know. But anyway, go figure. I'll probably get a
FAA or whoever.
You have been using your internet connection for useful work for too long. Cease and desist now.
Yeah. Anyway, what I was saying, like, Dan Ingles came across as one of the most humble yet intelligent people who thinks about programming and development the right attitude. It's very, very impressive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that podcast has been so inspirational that I would love for maybe this one even to become something like an open source bio software kind of, you know, focused podcast eventually. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that's kind of my hope also. I mean, definitely both of us have software kind of interests, so... And as our rigs become more sophisticated, right now I'm recording off an iSight camera into my MacBook. But over time, I think we'll get fancier, and we can probably pull in other people into the call also from time to time, right, depending on time zones and so on and so forth. But yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to where this goes. I think, you know, this was officially episode number one, and I think we did fairly well, you know, in terms of the kind of things that we've been talking about and thinking. I think this is a good place to start, and where it'll end up going,
we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's the Stack Overflow model again. They started off sort of talking like this, talking about some things of mutual interest, and now it's talking about Stack Overflow, the website, most of the time. But yeah, we'll have to see.
And I guess we can probably just end with the websites that we kind of oversee. So you could, like, I don't know, talk about your blog, and we could talk about...
Yes, yeah, we should do that, like in the true manner of everybody on to...
Oh, yeah, let's just plug sort of everything we do now.
Yeah, I know, and plus, yeah, so list all the sites you want to plug. So, so you can find my blog at mndoci.com. It's called Business Bytes, Genes, and Molecules, and it's pretty much how most people know me. You can pretty much find me on every website on the planet as MNDOCI, so Twitter, Friend Feed, which are the two places I tend to hang out. Other than that, yeah, and I have my wiki now, which is now deepaksingh.net, which sort of is a thoughts and general stream of consciousness on various topics and frustrations with my attempts at starting to write bad code and things like that. So I guess those are the ones I'll stick with today.
And I guess as for me, every time my experiments start to kind of go south, I stop blogging. But I do have a blog that I kind of feel strongly about, and that one's called code-itch.com. And that's the Code Itch blog. And both of us, of course, along with a couple of our friends, have for the last year or so, actually, it's already almost year and a half, I think, now?
Yeah, year and a half
how,
now.
How was the iPhone? I think that is the day we officially launched, right? The day the iPhone came out?
Yeah, the iPhone version
anyway,
one.
The website we're talking about is bioscreencast.com. That's basically a screencast resource for all of us, i.e. all the bio geeks out there. And associated with bioscreencast.com, we've also had the Bioscreencast Wiki, and that's kind of the wiki that I was talking about. So we'll probably cover, you know, have sections that are content relevant to this podcast on any of our sites. So there you go. Yeah, codeitch.com and Bioscreencast and Bioscreencastwiki.com.
Yeah, you should actually do a screencast accompanying sister screencast for this or something like that. Showing how to create a Deki extension or something like that. You know, something.
Yeah,
like
I've actually got a lot of help from Bjorg from Deki Wiki.
Yeah.
And I promised him I'll write a thing about how to write Deki extensions in Python. So maybe, yeah, there you go. I'll probably have that episode up. Have that screencast up.
Alrighty.
So cool. So I guess this is it. This is episode...
Yeah. End of screencast number one. This is where the music should kick in. I sent you a couple of audio files.
Yeah, I like
the
first one. So we'll...
Something I recorded randomly. And that was my intro. The other one, I think, was my outro. I forget. Or something that came in the middle between sections or something like that. But I'll let you figure out how you want to do it.
Okay, perfect. So this is it. Episode one of the Coast to Coast Biology Podcast. This is Hari Jayaram signing out from Massachusetts.
Yeah, and Deepak Singh from Issaquah, Washington.
All right.
Bye. Bye.